Hey, everybody, and welcome to the fifth installment of the Padverb Podcast. I'm your host, KMO, and in this episode of the podcast, I'm going to share a conversation that I recorded with Max Osborn of Osborn Capital Management. So typically in an episode like this, talking to somebody whose expertise is investing and such, I should say something along the lines of nothing you hear in this podcast is investment advice. But having just listened to the edited version of this podcast, there is nothing in here which could reasonably be construed as investment advice. We're talking very big picture stuff, geopolitics, energy, climate change, artificial intelligence, but mostly macroeconomics. In fact, as far as I recall, there's not even the mention of a single corporate name that you might invest in. In fact, I think the only companies we mentioned by name are Apple, TSMC, which is the Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Corporation, and a company that I had never heard of, but which plays a vital role, as the guest in this episode will spell out, ASML, which stands for Advanced Semiconductor Materials Lithography. They're a company based out of Veldhoven, Netherlands, and the whole chip manufacturing apparatus that takes place in Taiwan is utterly dependent on the output of this company. If nothing else, that's what I learned from this episode of the podcast, but I think you'll find this episode of the podcast is pretty content dense. There's a lot to be learned here. In fact, so much so that I can't really prepare you for some of the jargon-dense terminology that's going to be coming your way. The one thing I will throw out in advance is that in terms of setting interest rates, if you're a dove, you want low interest rates. If you're a hawk, you want high interest rates to fight inflation. But other than that, you're going into the deep end head first. Here we go. Here's my conversation with Max Osborn of Osborn Capital Management. You are listening to the Padverb Podcast. I am your host, KMO, and I am joined by Max Osborn, who, among other things, is a mathematician and an athlete, a decathlete, I believe, and also a partner and owner of Osborn Capital. So, Max, it is good to talk to you.
Yeah, thanks for having me, KMO.
My pleasure. So, you're into crypto, and at the time that we're recording this, crypto is suffering hard. I think Bitcoin, last I checked, was at 21,000, down from 65,000 last fall.
Yep.
So, and you know, most of my crypto portfolio is in altcoins because I don't think that Bitcoin has that much more room to grow.
Yep.
You know, not in the short term. So my portfolio is way down.
I get it.
So can you throw out any salves of hope or optimism, or is it absolute doom and destruction?
I do like the one stat that Bitcoin is actually, you know, it's up about 20% from its 2017 high, mm-hmm. right? So there's your indication of the cycle. I always feel like in these moments, it's kind of like the weather where, you know, you go out and it's a stormy day and you almost can't even believe, you know, what it would look like or imagine what it would look like if it was a sunny day. You know, the environment just totally envelops you. And that's what these kind of market crashes feel like. You know, it's like you can't even imagine what it would look like if we had green screens again, because there are all so many good reasons for markets to fall and there's so many fears out there. So, I think it would be helpful to get to start like kind of at the beginning of where how we got to where we are now, why these markets are falling and just like what the next phase looks like. I have some pretty clear views on that. And they're not really predictions. I think it's just more of the evolution of how this space goes. So I'm not surprised to hear that you're in alts because I was just at Crypto Bahamas and everyone there, right, they're not building on Bitcoin except for the Lightning folk. So like Bitcoin's old news. It's old technology. It's kind of like, well, where's the exciting stuff? Well, if you were early on the exciting stuff in the last 2 years, you know, you made a ton of money because you were on, early on the narratives, right? So Solana, faster, right? More transactions per second, like great narrative to drive the price, great backers, great people building that system. Or Avalanche, like unbelievable team, you know, another alternative, you know, layer one solution, right? With all kinds of interesting, you know, developer applications, let's just call them. But what I think a lot of the problem was with a lot of this and what we're seeing now is like a lot of the ecosystem was very recursive. So you just kind of had like crypto trading between crypto, levering up crypto to swap other crypto, to bridge other crypto. And
DeFi in a nutshell right there.
DeFi in a nutshell. But like it all works. And I think that's the most important part. And so, yeah, we don't need to be trading native tokens back and forth on DeFi. and call that a day, right? What we really need is real assets on those blockchains, on those DeFi rails. And the first one that we got is USDC, right? That's the first real asset that's been tokenized. And it's easy because it's such a simple thing. It's just a dollar, right? It doesn't take much to tokenize that. But, that's pretty exciting.
So at least here in the early parts of the conversation, let's try to keep it as general audience friendly as possible. So USDC is a stable coin, which means it's always worth $1. It is pegged to the dollar.
It's really important that it's understood that it's pegged to the dollar, because there's a lot of stable coins and there are a lot of algorithmic stable coins that are not pegged one-to-one to the dollar. And USDC, I just happen to know those guys because I used to live across the street from them in Boston for the last 8 years. That's how I got so deep into crypto. But, you know, they were created by Circle. Circle was the first Goldman-backed or, you know, big bank-backed crypto project, right? And so when Goldman invested in Circle, it was kind of like, okay, there's real players here. There's real traditional finance, like heavy hitters. Eventually, they came up with, well, let's just like one-to-one ERC-20 token these dollars into a stable coin that can live on a blockchain. Now, they can do it on any of them, but most of the money, like $50 billion or so, is on Ethereum. And to keep it audience friendly, the reason that this is exciting is it's tokenizing a real world asset. Like a dollar is still a conceptual asset, but it is a real world asset, and that you use it to pay for your groceries, you use it to pay for rent. Like none of us use Ethereum for anything other than crypto stuff, right?
NFTs.
Yeah.
Well, the stock markets are also in the doldrums seriously right now. So we can't blame crypto for this, but certainly the crash of a different stablecoin, one of the algorithmic stablecoins you mentioned, it has certainly put the fear into a lot of people who, you know, otherwise might be interested in crypto right now. I'm talking about Terra Luna.
Yeah.
I didn't have much Luna, fortunately.
Yeah.
But it's gone to, you know, fractions of a penny on the dollar in its value in a very short time.
Yeah.
One thing I think the current situation has made clear is that all this talk of crypto, particularly Bitcoin, being an inflation hedge, it's not really tracking with reality, because, you know, if we're having high inflation, which we are, you would think that an inflation hedge like Bitcoin would be going up right now. But in fact, it's just like any other stock on the NASDAQ. It's like a high risk tech stock, basically the way investors treat it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll let you comment on that.
So the Bitcoin is the only asset at size that's non-dilutive. And what I mean, it just can't expand. Everyone talks about 21 million coins, but that's sort of irrelevant because they can be fractionalized down to sats, right? You don't have to own just one Bitcoin. So it's really 100% of a network. And I'm pretty sure, I think it's fair to say confidently that it's the only asset of its size that cannot be diluted. And so in that case, it's sort of a pre-inflation hedge in that, like, when you're printing a lot of money and you're expanding the money supply, you can hold Bitcoin and know that you're holding an asset that's not expanding, that's not getting diluted. And what you eventually get to is when you print a lot of money, you eventually get to inflation. And now we're in inflation, but the reason Bitcoin's going down as inflation is going up, and we're saying, okay, it's not an inflation hedge. No, it's not an inflation hedge, because when you get that actual inflation print, that CPI print, you know, like we're having now, we have the Fed come out and they say, well, they need to raise rates. Well, when the Fed raises rates, they suck liquidity out of the system. They're basically trying to crush demand. They're trying to, you know, slow the economy. And because Bitcoin is not really used for anything other than, you know, kind of the store of value and this futuristic, emergent technology tool. When you suck money out of the system, you're going to suck money out of Bitcoin too. And you're not going to have a bid on markets that looks anywhere near 60,000. It's going to be closer to the 20,000 we are now. And that's a one-way train until the Fed changes their tune. I mean, when the Fed goes dovish, like, you can go all in on this stuff. You can bet it's probably going to do really well. It's unfortunate, but it's kind of the reality. It's all one trade. It's either you're long or short, kind of the liquidity of the Fed.
Well, we're recording this on June 16th, and yesterday the Fed was supposed to make an announcement about interest rates. I haven't heard it yet. What did they do?
Doubled the rate from 0.75 to 1.5, right? And I don't know how you look at these markets, but, you know, market took off pretty aggressively, positively, in reaction right after that. I think it was just sort of a relief rally. I mean, I don't know even what you call it, but we're retracing all of that today. So as much as the market liked that yesterday, they really don't like it today. It's only been 24 hours. I think interestingly, 1.5 where we're at today is where we were right before the pandemic. And we actually cut rates to 1.5 right before the pandemic to stimulate the economy. So honestly, I don't know what to think about all that because, all right, we're heading into, call it slower growth, Trump and, you know, they're vying to cut rates. We cut them to 1.5 to stimulate the economy. We have COVID, we cut rates to zero, print 10 trillion, it's too much. Now we're cutting, I'm sorry, we're raising rates. I think we're doing it too late. And all of a sudden you get this, you know, shrinking effect on the stock market, shrinking effect on the economy. I mean, it's kind of wild to see all of these moves in such a short period of time. I mean, it's been 3 years of just crazy markets.
I haven't really put on my macroeconomics hat for this conversation, but, you know, now that we're into these waters, I think what everybody who, you know, understands the terminology wants to avoid is stagflation, mm-hmm. where you have inflation and no growth. Mm-hmm. We've narrowly avoided that in the recent decades, but we haven't had serious stagflation, as far as I understand it, since like the 70s.
Yeah.
I've been looking through your Twitter feed. I know that you're skeptical of people who claim to have sophisticated models that allows them to see the future, but, you know, looking through your crystal ball, what is your forecast on that?
Yeah, so where that comes from is the complex systems theory, which is, you know, an area that I'm a fan of. And it really, you know, kind of relates down to like, you can run your statistical models, but these are really complex, interwoven, dynamic exponential systems, right? So the little changes, you know, have big impacts. Where do we go from here? I honestly don't know. Like, I just have to throw up a big, I don't know, because, you know, it would seem that the market like that maybe the Fed should raise rates very fast, right? Maybe we should have done a full point yesterday. Maybe we should do another point next month and just like rip the Band-Aid off and get back to some kind of, I don't know, whatever our next phase is going to be. But the problem that I see is that everyone who zooms out, you know, past a 5-year window on any of the chart, you can see that rates have always trended towards zero in the modern era, right? And, you know, so how long until we cut rates again, right? This is basically just reloading the gun until we cut rates. And if you go down this line, you follow it, you get to a bunch of justified, cynical, you know, anti-Fed type people, because they're saying, you know, basically since 08, 09, we've just been in a perpetual bailout, which is kind of where we're going to be next in a few years, right? We're going to cut rates again. We're going to do something to stimulate the economy. I don't know what happens in the short run. It's pretty gnarly. I mean, you know, houses are incredibly unaffordable for everyone, you know, unless you're an all cash buyer and then you don't have to even take out a loan, right? But you still will, but you'll get preferential rates if you do. And all the people who get paid in options on these high growth tech companies or you know, joined crypto or have a large part of the network, all their money just evaporated, right? If you had stock options in a company that are now underwater, like that's usually your down payment. Right. Your first, you know, company that you stayed on with for 4 or 5 years that went public and now you have the stock options, you know, that company falls 90%. A few years ago, it was just WeWork, right? That was the first one to crater. Now it's all of them. You know, all of them are down, you know, between 60, 70 and even 90%. And like that has to have a knock on effect because there are a lot of people who are employed by those companies who are educated, high risk, high growth, talented people. And now they're just, you know, their balance sheet was just blown up.
How about the war in Ukraine and the effects on the availability of food and fossil fuels? You know, basically depriving a lot of the global economy of fossil fuel supplies, driving up prices.
Yeah.
You know, particularly of gasoline and diesel fuel. How does that affect the larger model and the larger economy as you see it?
So, I haven't historically been an energy guy, but I'm quickly becoming one, right? Because you kind of have to, you know, start looking at that. So, so liquid natural gas is responsible for about 40% of the electricity in the United States. And that price is 4x, the liquid natural gas price is 4x. And now we're a net exporter. We send it to Europe as well. As far as I can tell, no one wants to invest in oil and gas. Because, you know, we've made these commitments to, you know, environmental commitments, right? That basically say, like, it's both politically unpopular to invest in oil and it's, you know, been financially a devastating, you know, asset class. So you've got like hundreds of billions of losses. And now for the first time, you have a profitable energy sector. So like, if you're an oil CEO, I don't know, you're like, maybe we just hold on to this high profit margin for a little bit longer. right? Instead of investing right away into projects that everyone's going to tell us were, you know, evil. And I'm not trying to be political on it, but like, if you're going to have like a 10-year lifespan for a project before you, you know, to get the return you need on it, but, you know, people are actively telling you to shut it down and don't want you to do it, you're kind of like, well, I'll just take my dividend now from these high liquid natural gas prices, high oil prices. The thing with Russia and Ukraine, I don't know what to think there. I mean, that's honestly, I tend to think that these, the crisis idea, the idea that there's a food crisis, that we will not get food, seems alarmist to me. I do think that we can get what we need. We can get food supplies, whether, you know, I've heard murmurs that like China has large supplies of food. So if they come in to save the day in Africa, or they, I think they have much, much larger stocks of supplies. I just don't think we're headed towards famine. I tend to be an optimist, and I always reject the idea that we're going to have an imminent catastrophe. Like, you know, we have some pretty strong ingenuity, and it only takes a couple people. If you clear the road for them, some pretty good leaders with some good capital can get a lot done. And we saw it with baby food shortage. It's like, you know, we have these like ultra restrictive kind of monopolistic forces in the United States that led to the shortage. And all of a sudden we were like, okay, we sent some military planes to Europe. And all of a sudden we got, you know, a ton of baby formula right on demand. And so it's kind of like, I really think we need better leadership. I don't know how to feel like everyone feels like that, but
you don't have to shy away from politics. I mean, you're certainly welcome to have a political opinion and to express it. The government policy affects everything that we've been talking about.
Yeah.
So there's no need to exclude it from the conversation.
Well, I've been feeling pretty, like, honestly, I've been feeling pretty like frustrated by it, because one of the big lessons from complex systems is about leadership and leadership setting the tone on what can and should be done. And I feel like this is a good time to loosen up some of these restrictions and just clear the way for good leaders to act. Like, this just seems like a perfect time to like let some strong leaders take the reins and make some hard decisions and be a strong leader. You know, I think that's where a lot of this like anti-wokeism comes from, because they're like, yeah, I know these things are important, but like, also someone please step up and just make some strong, hard decisions and make some things happen. I don't know how you do that.
I'm frustrated by the woke politics just because I see it as a complete distraction from matters that need to be attended to.
Yeah.
But you are you in Boston right now?
I'm in Miami right now.
You're in Miami, but you live in Massachusetts in the Boston area.
Yeah.
So in the Northeast, you know, particularly Boston and New York, one would imagine that somebody in your position would be a sort of vote blue no matter who kind of person, but libertarianism tends to run strong crypto scenes and in the tech scene.
Yeah.
So I imagine that's kind of an awkward or at least a tension filled environment to be operating in.
I don't know. You know, libertarian doesn't like work with me. Just only like I love the libertarian ideals, but they all ultimately end up being a little kind of like anarchy related, right? They're very like Occupy it can be a little too aggressive. Like, I'll just throw out the Team of Teams book by Stanley McChrystal on complex systems. To me, is like the best leadership book written, you know, in the modern age. And I just think it tells the story of like all the leadership failures that happen and what you need to do to be a good leader in a modern era, which is you really need to be adaptable. Like, adaptation is much more important than efficiency in 2022. So, or in, you know, and going forward. And I think that's what people like about crypto, because it's software, it can be iterated on very quickly. And so that like fits really well with that. But really, like that book, Team of Teams, it starts talking about like, how do you be a leader? So Stanley McChrystal was in Iraq or Afghanistan. And, you know, they were suffering huge losses to guerrilla warriors who were like much more nimble and applying these almost like lean startup type, you know, organization tactics against this like big behemoth, like very structured, telegraphing all their moves, you know, military. And he's like, we just keep getting smoked. He's like, we need to be nimble and efficient. We need to share information openly, even though it risks leaks, which is sort of how I feel about like cloud computing. I know that like people want HIPAA requirements and they want like financial data to be secure, but I do think we would be better off opening up those rails and like sharing as much data as possible. It'll like speed up the healthcare system and speed up the financial system. That's kind of their trade-off. Like you always have the trade-off. And then you need, you know, another thing in that book is like, you need to allow people at the edges to make your decisions. Like, you need to let your employees. And I just like run in personally, like anecdotally, I run into all these bureaucratic situations all the time. Like, if you're ever stuck in the airport with like you're trying to get something you left on the plane, or like, you know, it's like they have a set of procedures and the employees are not at all enabled to make any kind of decision. I think it's like, you know, takes away from the humanity. Society should be able to like not waste people's time, just make a decision on the end and like trust your people.
Are you familiar with George Friedman, the geopolitical analyst?
No.
Well, he's been at it for decades, but his most recent book is called The Storm Before the Calm. And he's talking about the various turbulence-producing factors that are going to make the 2020s a very rocky road. Wow. But he says that in the 2030s, you know, we're going to basically move into a new paradigm. And part of that new paradigm will be the devolving of decision-making authority to people closer to the places where decisions have to be made, which is to say, getting away from this rigid, bureaucratic, hierarchical, you know, operating mentality, which I think you're describing his, you know, it causes misery at the local level, but from the top, you know, that's far away. You don't really care. Yeah. And the models that people are describing to you about how the system actually operates are very sunny and they're very friendly to your point of view. Yeah. And you don't have to actually be the guy in line at the DMV who's got the wrong paperwork. It doesn't really affect your life.
Yeah. Yeah. So, absolutely. I do think that we need to move in that direction, because you think about like the job of the president. I don't know. I haven't spent enough time around DC to understand like the nuances of how it functions, but like, I don't know, I have a hard time just managing my own life. How do you have the bandwidth or time? You can't. You have to delegate an enormous amount to people who you trust, right? And so then I'm like, what are they even doing right over there? Like, I wish we could hear, maybe I'm just not in touch with it, but like, I think we need more supply chain positive policy to support, you know, these kinks in the supply chain, because the Fed tool of tightening markets is only a demand increase or decrease function. We need policy out there to see however we can do it. Like, maybe even you just hand out a couple hundred billion to the oil companies to say, hey, I know it's not going to be profitable. Just make a whole bunch of oil and you can reduce those energy costs and you can start to bring down inflation from the supply side, right? Because that supply demand function on increasing prices is like, we have a problem on the supply side. That's where this all came from. It came from COVID, right? Shutting down supply chains.
Now, I'm friendly to the notion that we were really overextended with globalization. Basically, we really should bring a lot of our production back home.
Yeah.
And that if COVID sort of gives us a kick in the pants to start down that direction, that's probably, you know, ultimately a good thing.
Yeah. So the number one thing I follow on this is semiconductor production in Taiwan. Like, it's super fascinating to me that it seems like there's only a handful of people in the world, like really a handful, I think. Maybe it's like fewer than 100, right? That really know like the details of how you make literally like the iPhone that we all have, like the M1 chip or M2 chip now. Like, how do you, like ASML, the chain is ASML, TSMC, and you know, ultimately Apple, right? So ASML makes the machines. These are like the most incredible, you know, machines ever produced by man, right? They're the ones that are etching, you know, these chips. TSMC in Taiwan buys these machines from ASML, and like, there's only a handful of people at ASML or TSMC who have any idea how to do this stuff, right? So part of the problem of deglobalization of the semiconductor supply chain, it's like, yeah, you can try to build your plants in Arizona, which is what they're trying to do, or Ohio, or anywhere other than Taiwan. But like, they don't also seem to have the talent to operate those machines, build those machines, run those programs. And by the way, it takes, like a lot of these things, it takes like multiple years. So we're not really going to see movement on that deglobalization of semiconductor manufacturing until like probably 4 or 5 years from now, just given how difficult this problem is. It's a really cool, fascinating area to like go into the semiconductor production, by the way. It's just like the it's true science fiction.
So TSCM, I think it is, the Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Corporation, without one particular plant in Taiwan, basically the global economy is crippled.
Yeah.
In terms of, you know, supplying cars, phones, all kinds of military equipment, like the US military,
yeah,
is utterly dependent on chips from Taiwan. So, you know, the idea that the US is going to sit by and just watch the communist Chinese roll into to Taiwan and take it, we simply cannot. We absolutely cannot allow that.
You know, I don't know how I feel about this, because I will say that like last year I did a big list of all my like top risks in markets. And I would say that every single one of them have hit except for the number one risk on that list, which is Taiwan gets invaded by China or something related to that effect. And because all of those other risks have hit, it's almost like a Murphy's Law. Like if you can identify the risk, it's going to happen. Like multiples compressed, like Fed, you know, inflation, you know, all these things like taking over. It's kind of like, oh, might as well just start planning for it. I mean, honestly, I hope we get something in place well before, you know, I hope we get some like manufacturing moving around outside of just Taiwan TSMC, because we're just like hopelessly reliant on that one little chain. I mean, we're all reliant on Apple products. Our like, you know, my iPhone and my Apple laptop are like literally, I spend all my time on them, right? And all of Apple's products are reliant on TSMC.
So you mentioned earlier that they are building a plant in Arizona. That is TSMC. That's, as you say, a multi-year process, probably a decade-long process to get that plant up and running and actually churning out chips.
Yeah.
It is no trivial task. One possible optimistic take, though, that I don't think is too unrealistic, is that the example of Russia failing to take Ukraine in a timely fashion, which I imagine they thought they were just going to roll in with minimal resistance and achieve their objectives quickly, and they have not. Now, that's not to say that, you know, the Ukrainians are going to fight off the Russians. They're not. Eventually, Russia will win. But this has been a long, grinding slog for the Russians, and it's been very costly to them, you know, in terms of their international prestige and the ability of you know, just Russian people to live their lives in a normal fashion. That might have put the fear of God into Xi Jinping. You know, if the Ukraine invasion had gone by the numbers, then, you know, the Taiwan invasion might already be underway. But it, you know, there might be reason to think that Xi Jinping is sitting back and reassessing now that he's seen that it wasn't a cakewalk for Russia.
I hope so. I mean, I don't know. It's definitely outside of my scope of understanding. You know, I think it opens one area that's interesting to try to understand is the cultural differences between these countries. You know, it's like, what is the culture like over in China? What is the culture like over in Russia? And how does that drive these decisions? You know, and it's striking to me when I start digging into what that culture is like in Russia. And a lot of that Russian culture seems to be driven more on like pride related to the USSR, right? Former USSR, and like getting that back, restoring that. And so if that's driving decisions, you know, that seems different, very different from what we're used to in the United States. You're like, well, he's crazy. And like, you read all these news stories, he's crazy. And you're like, I think he's just doing like fulfilling his vision of like, you know, restoring the USSR. And then you go to China and you're like, well, they seem to be better at long-term planning, right? Thinking about like sacrificing the short term in favor of the long term and having these like 100-year plans. That's also something that like you don't seem to see like in the United States as like a cultural way. Like we're very focused on short term in the United States.
Yes. Although I think trying to make 100-year plans is probably just foolishness in the opposite direction. You know, as we've talked about with complex adaptive systems, the outputs of those systems are, they tend to be not only exaggerated, but really non-intuitive and non-linear.
Yeah.
So trying to plot out 100 years worth of, you know, responses to stimuli, it's not right. Likely to succeed.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there are certain things you can do that you don't have to be really sophisticated in your forecasts to know that it's going to be a good thing, like planting trees. It's kind of hard to go wrong planting trees, really. You know, unless you're planting them in a place where they're just not going to get enough water to grow.
Well, it seems like you're from my understanding, your background, you're pretty deep on the climate side. Can we talk about that a little bit?
I certainly wouldn't present myself as any sort of expert on that topic. I'm certainly interested.
Yeah.
You know, I'm interested in big picture things. So I'm interested in geopolitics. I'm interested in energy. I'm interested in economics. So yeah, obviously ecology, climate systems, those are all incredibly relevant to our lives. And in fact, I think it was, I think I'm quoting Daniel Pinchbeck here, or maybe Charles Eisenstein, but somebody who was writing on economics from an ecological perspective was saying, look, the physical world, particularly the biological world, it's not some variable that you can discount. It is the primary reality that we have to work with. All of these economic metrics, these are abstractions that we can let them go if they're not useful anymore. But, you know, the biological systems upon which we all depend, those are primary.
Yeah.
From my perspective, there's no arguing with that. But as going through your Twitter feed, I noticed that you had retweeted something from a climate scientist, and his name is Zeke Hausfather, it looks like. And he is a climate scientist, and he's not a denialist, and he's not any sort of Panglossian optimist, but he's saying, like, he posted that he rejects the notion that any child born today is being doomed to some apocalyptic hellscape.
Yeah.
You know, that we do have agency still. We still have the ability to at least mitigate, if not fix, climate issues. Mm-hmm. And he got just a fuselage, just a tsunami of angry pushback from people who are really, really attached to the idea that we are doomed. Mm-hmm. And I know personally that there are a lot of people who are strongly invested in the idea that industrial civilization is in its last days. There is no saving it whatsoever. There will be a massive population correction, you know, to the tune of maybe 500 million people will be left on the earth after the correction. And I inhabited that mindset for a few years, but I have publicly rejected it.
Yeah.
And it cost me a sizable portion of my audience, because a lot of the people who were listening to my, you know, my output were really invested in that.
Yeah.
And I just have no use for it anymore.
Well, there is a large group of people that they like to catastrophize, and it happens with gold, like the gold people, gold bugs, which are similar to the Bitcoin people, right? That's like guns, Bitcoin, and like you land and live out in the wilderness and let society fail. And, you know, they can kind of come to you to get their grain supply when it all finally collapses, right? I think they secretly want to see some of that failure. I don't necessarily know where that comes from, but like, we saw it with gold. We're seeing it with like the Bitcoin people. I just don't think that you can like ever catastrophize, because I think like if you want to look at the math or statistics or history, all of this is so unlikely. All of the things that happen to achieve success are so unlikely and so statistically rare that like another statistically rare anomaly can also save us. Right. And then you only need one or two like really talented entrepreneurs out of a pool of, you can say, hundreds of million people or millions of a certain subset of people. You only need one or two of those people to make like an outsized impact to help. So I just cannot buy into like the catastrophe. What I do think is, you know, a reality is like more flooding, dealing with hurricanes, dealing with weather. Like I saw you retweeted, like Mexico City had that crazy hailstorm, and people are walking around. It's like snow in Mexico City in June. Yeah, I think we're going to have like a lot of that, right? We're going to have a lot of odd weather that's going to be extraordinarily disruptive to our lives. And that's going to require us to be more adaptive. That's where like you have to throw out efficiency and be more adaptive. And that's why like working remotely via Zoom is like probably a little bit better than like getting on flights and meeting people in person, if you can stomach it. And if everyone's okay with that, is it saves a lot of time. It saves like the jet fuel and just the other, you know, impact on the environment. I'm like very, very pro, you know, Zoom kind of style, because also, you know, it untethers you from your real estate. Like if you live in a hurricane zone, flood zone, or whatever it is, like you can, if you like, your life is more work from home, and not everyone has that luxury, but a lot of people can, right? Like bankers, right? Bankers are like being drawn back in by Goldman Sachs. Like that's their culture, but I don't think that that's necessary. Like that might be their culture, but their job can be done remotely.
You know, you mentioned that I had retweeted, it's a video of people in Mexico City. It's like underneath the elevated train track, and there's so much hail that it looks like there's been a blizzard and people are, you know, having to high step to get through it. And the person who posted that, who I retweeted it from, they said, if you're not worried, you're not paying attention.
Right.
And I reposted it, but I put in a little snippet from Mary Smirch, who wrote this very famous commencement address, which got circulated, falsely attributed to Kurt Vonnegut. And then Baz Luhrmann, Australian film director, he got an actor to read it and put it to music several years ago. But it's basically advice, mm-hmm, to graduates. And one of the pieces of advice was, and you know, reproducing from memory here, but don't worry about the future. But if you do, just know that worrying is about as effective as trying to solve an algebra equation by chewing bubble gum.
Right.
The real things that are going to kick your ass are not going to be the things that you expected. They're going to be the things that blindside you on a random Tuesday afternoon.
Right.
You know. So my whole point was that this whole, if you're not worried, you're not paying attention, that's just completely false.
Right.
If you're not worried, it just means that you've taken... It could mean that you're oblivious, sure, but it could also mean that you're well-informed, but you understand that place of upset, that place of indignant, you know, anger at the hopelessness of the situation, that's a psychological construct. That's sort of a neurological addiction that you've become, you know,
yeah,
that you have allowed to take hold. Mm-hmm. And
I just have no patience for it. And it is for that same reason that I have no patience for, you know, the far left woke fixation on the injustice of, you know, gender and race. I mean, I recognize that there are injustices around those things, but they are not the primary movers in our world. And they're certainly not the primary things that require our attention at this time.
Right.
Okay. So I've delved into politics there.
Yeah. No, definitely.
Broken the seal. Go for it.
Definitely some hot wires on that. But one thing that I'd like to discuss here, just a kind of a question to pose, because I feel like it's really the one that is a huge driver. Because I think, like, we're both, you know, investors in tech. You're an investor in, you know, crypto, especially the alt crypto. It's sort of this notion right now that, like, because of the prices, people get like justification for their kind of negative takes on everything. So this question. Have we already experienced like the bulk of the tech revolution? Like, is that already behind us? Because we already got cloud, right? Cloud already exists. How much cloud have we already built? How much more are we going to get out of building more cloud? And how much are we going to get out of blockchain? Like, there are a lot of people now, you know, as we head into like, call it like a crypto winter, who are saying like, yeah, no, blockchain was just like a test, right? You get Nassim Taleb, who like a lot of people respect, who's like pretty aggressive against, you know, all things crypto, all things blockchain. So the anti-tech, anti, you know, blockchain narratives are really strong right now. Like, we know AI is coming, and we know that cloud computing is really powerful, and we know that there are some interesting things with blockchain, but it sort of feels, I think it's something interesting to talk about, like it sort of feels like the negative narratives are winning right now. I mean, at least they have for the last year.
Well, with blockchain in particular, there are a lot of people who have an environmental sensibility who are just angry and resentful of blockchain because it uses so much energy, which is really unnecessary.
Yeah,
I'm going to sidestep the whole proof of work, proof of stake thing. I have listened to a lot of people who say that, look, proof of work is really the only fair way to go. Proof of stake is just oligarchy. And I'm amenable to that point of view, but I don't want to dwell on it. But with crypto and blockchain technologies, like from 2015, even maybe before that, like 2014 is when I first started getting this whiff of this mania about how revolutionary blockchain is going to be. And the applications, the potential applications that people have been describing have either been so esoteric that I couldn't really get my head around them, or they just haven't really seemed to be all that big a deal. And I've been waiting for the killer app. And it seems like the killer app is NFTs. So far,
yeah,
which, you know, is like, yeah, how to introduce scarcity into an environment where digital artifacts can be infinitely replicated. Mm-hmm. It just seems kind of trivial. If this is what we've been waiting for, you know, to validate the blockchain as this useful technology, I'm not really convinced.
Oh.
There's also decentralized autonomous organizations. To me, that's a better candidate for the killer app. But
okay,
you have something to say about NFTs, I can tell. So I'll stop. Go ahead.
Well, so, like the NFT name, like all these names, they get sort of abused, right? Because they get regurgitated like a million times over and over and over. Now it's just like ape JPEGs or whatever. Like they sort of don't get a fair take. They end up in a cynical bucket. It just like happens, right? Anything that gets that amount of coverage. But like what's cool about NFTs, and even to get even a little bit deeper into it, there's really three standards. There's the ERC-20, which is like just a fungible token. Then you have what the 720, I think, is that's the NFT. And then you have the 1155, which is both fungible and NFT, like fungible and non-fungible tokens. And that's really cool because now you can fractionalize an asset. So if you get back to the real world, real estate maps well for NFTs, but people own fractional shares of real estate. So that fractional NFT system, that 1155, is really good for real estate style like tokenization. Because we might have a building and then split it up and split that building and maybe even split up the apartment units into their own NFTs. And then you can split those units into other fractional ownership shares. So we already kind of do this with REITs, right? We have like a REIT is a fungible asset because you sort of don't care. I mean, you care, but you don't really care what that REIT owns. You just are saying it's a telecom REIT. It's a data center REIT.
What does REIT stand for?
Oh, Real Estate Investment Trust. Right? It's a publicly traded real estate basket. And you sort of don't care, right? You're just like, we're going to buy and sell Simon properties, which is like all mall properties. And like the Simon equity you know, ticker is a fungible ticker. I can sell it to you, I can trade it, and it all is the same. But the actual underlying properties, those are like NFTs, because they're every piece of real estate is inherently a unique piece of real estate. And so this is part of my like next thing of like, it's going to take a long time. Like maybe it takes a couple of years, but we're going to start tokenizing that real estate. Like we're going to tokenize everything, or at least try to tokenize everything. And right, so if you can start applying an NFT structure towards real estate, you can start taking those assets and applying them to like all this cool, crazy, like experimental crypto stuff. Like you could have DeFi tools related to real estate, and then you can buy and sell the real estate. You can trade the real estate. We invested in a company in Boston recently that is, I think, going to be the leader in this space because they approach it from the government side first, right? Like there is no disconnect between like government and real estate. Like they're so intertwined. Like you're not going to be able to do tokenized real estate without the SEC and the government like fully involved. But that's what they're doing. And you know, if you can securitize it, like it is going to be a security. Like tokenized real estate will because you have cash flow and you have people who have to show up, maintain properties. The whole reason you have securities like the SEC is to make sure those people show up and do their jobs and make those payments. Like that's part of the regulation that needs to be involved. So when you end up tokenizing real estate, you get these NFTs. And the invention of, call it that killer app, the NFT, it allows blockchain to map better to the real world, which is that a lot of things are unique, right? You know, a lot of things are non-fungible in the real world.
Sorry, I had popped away there to Twitter. I was looking for a tweet that you had made recently about your takeaways from a crypto conference that you had attended, I think, in the Bahamas.
Yeah, Crypto Bahamas, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the first point that you made there, it involved regulation. It touched very specifically on what you were just talking about, I thought. So I was just looking for it so I could read the exact wording.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, is that it? Okay, well, I will just try to reproduce it from memory.
Sure.
You said something to the effect that institutional players are anxious to get into crypto, but they can't really do it yet.
Exactly.
Because, and this is just my understanding, there's not adequate regulation around it yet.
Yeah, so when you're working at a pension, or you're working at a sovereign wealth fund or any of those, like you're a collection of fiduciaries. It's not your own money. It's not like your family office. It's not your brokerage account. And so like your fiduciary responsibility means like you could be fired for breaching that, right? And fiduciary, by the way, just means like you're making decisions in the best interest of like the end user. And like what's funny about this is like a lot of those pensions, you know, they're teachers' pensions, firemen's pensions, sovereign wealth funds, like these are large pools of capital that benefit like an enormous number of people. But when you work for them, you can't like degen into like a random crypto protocol. Like it's just so unacceptable. So all of the major like crypto hedge funds are more or less like private capital, you know, from like early whales and whatever. They're operating in the hedge fund structure because like you can do whatever you want, right? Like you can short Luna, you can go long Luna, you can do like, you can play on literally any, you can swap NFTs, you can mint NFTs, you can create NFTs. Like you can do whatever you want, but if you want a mandated, if you want an institution to participate, it needs to be like highly regulated. The institutional capital world will not have a 1 or 2 or 5% allocation to token assets or crypto assets until it is completely regulated to the point that they can satisfy their fiduciary responsibility. By the way, that's why the retail had to jump on institutions for the first time, right? Because they were the ones who took the risk first, because institutions can't. So when you do, like we may be going into this world where like you have enough regulation, maybe it's a CFTC, like commodities, they treat Bitcoin as a commodity or Ethereum as a commodity, some things as a security. I think they will be split, like some things will have to be a security, some things will be a commodity.
For the general audience member, what is the important difference between a security and a commodity?
Well, so like a commodity is just like, I think it works well just to think about it in base terms, like wheat. Right. Like if we just have a whole bunch of grain or coffee beans, like your coffee beans are not very much different from my coffee beans. So we can swap them and like trade them on the open market. And so, you know, commodities refer to like oil, you know, coffee beans, frozen orange juice concentrate. If you ever saw that, Trading Places, that old, you know, Eddie Murphy movie. Right. Yeah. And then securities are, you know, Apple stock, because like Tim Cook needs to show up to work. Everyone needs to show up to work, produce the product, file the bank statements that say that like the figures are accurate, pay out the dividends, do the, you know, all their financial activities. And so that needs to be treated as a security, because like, this is my understanding. I'm not a securities lawyer, but like from a basic level, it makes sense to me that if people need to show up to work to make that thing exist, that's a security.
Gotcha.
Like a company, but like coffee beans are coffee beans. You can leave them on the shelf for like 6 months, go back to them and sell them on the open market. It's a commodity. So like Bitcoin is like a great example of like what should be a commodity. Cause like you can leave it in a hot wallet, cold wallet, wherever, and you come back to it, it's still Bitcoin. And a lot of these DeFi protocols are self-operating. So like you can leave it and come back to it and like they'll still work, which is really cool. Super automated businesses. But, you know, real estate is not a commodity. Like that is an operating project. It's got a lease, it's got a legal contract.
You are listening to the Padverb Podcast. I'm your host, KMO, and I'm speaking with Max Osborne of Osborne Capital Management. And I want to acknowledge somebody in the chat, James, several minutes ago when I was talking about the killer app for blockchain. He says, blockchain eliminates corruption as a possibility in a truthful consensus. And I understand what each of those words means on its own, but I'm not sure I understand the totality of that statement. What do you take that to mean, and do you agree?
Well, I do agree, but with like a million caveats, because like blockchain is still so early and it's such a big category. So like you still need your decentralization, your security, that blockchain.
What do you take James to be saying though? What's his point paraphrased?
Well, yeah, just to get right to it. I guess the idea is like Bitcoin is supposed to be above the governments, right? And so like you can't have theoretically corruption in Bitcoin, because that system is decentralized enough and large enough that like the governments can't control it. And it's so rules based that if you just know the three or four rules of how the system operates there, and then there's no corruption. Like no one can just make more Bitcoin on a Tuesday and like ruin your finances with that. So yeah, I do agree with the sentiment. Absolutely. And I think that's what gets people excited. And I know there's a book coming out about this. I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name all right, but Balaji Srinivasan, right?
Yeah. I was actually going to ask you about Balaji Srinivasan. He's one thing that I heard him say, probably talking to Tim Ferriss, was that the value of a dollar is very stable from day to day, but over decades, the value goes to practically zero. You know, the dollar has lost over 90% of its value since it was created, or since 1972.
Yeah.
And with crypto, particularly Bitcoin, it's the opposite. The value fluctuates wildly from day to day and week to week and month to month. But over the long term, if you pull way back, its value is increasing steadily.
I think that's really well said. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, I think that goes to your like inflation hedge question earlier. It's like, it's not like an inflation hedge, like in the moment. And if you like those charts that you just drew are like crossing, right? So it's like high volatility short term, high growth long term, opposite for the dollar. Like inflation happens in the middle. So yeah, you're getting inflation and like Bitcoin's going wild. And yeah, okay. I like the way you said that. But the reason I brought up Balaji in relation to this comment is his next book coming out is How to Start a Nation, which I'm speculating really is like how to basically like use the internet and blockchain to like, you know, jump a little bit, a level higher than like these government organizations, which, you know, really the government controls. I think like Elon Musk says, they have a monopoly on violence, and they're really the owners of the land. Like when you own land, you are basically renting it from the government.
Yeah, you pay rent to the government. And if you don't, and, you know, if you don't pay rent in the form of property taxes, they take it.
Yeah.
You know, and if you don't leave, they send men with guns.
That's the agreement, though. It's pretty clear.
Yes. And still, I mean, it is the one asset that, like every other asset, you can imagine it falling and crashing and going to nothing, but not real estate.
Right.
You know, even in a world where we have Zoom and people can work from home, cows eat grass, you know, as long as you want to keep eating hamburgers, there's got to be some fields out there with cows grazing.
Right. And what's caught my attention about real estate is how many times people said cities were dead during COVID. And I think you just like forget that like groups of people coming together is like perfect example of this complex system stuff. Like you get this emergent properties, that's how you get like all these amazing universities, all these amazing companies. Like they are in the middle of these cities because that's where all the people are. And like I think that's never going to change. I think that's a core like organism organizing property of like humanity. So like, I think, yeah, you could bet on a city, no question. Now, like if it goes underwater, like, I don't know, that's a whole nother story, but like that collection of people investing in cities is probably always going to be a good trade.
You know, I just got an image from the Steven Spielberg film AI at the end of the film, and it's a quest movie. The characters go to Manhattan, which is flooded, and you know, all these skyscrapers are sticking up out of the water, but it's not abandoned. You know, there's still people living there. It's still a thriving city. It's just, you know, it's half wrecked.
Sounds like, you know, we're just gonna have to like swallow the pill on some of this climate change stuff. Like, it's just gonna be harder. Like, things are just gonna be more difficult, and that doesn't mean catastrophe. It just means that we have to live with it.
You know, our species, our evolutionary specialization is communication, forecasting, and adaptation, really. That's just what we do. We have collective action because we have language. We can build models that can be counterfactual, so we can talk about the future and different versions of the future, depending on what we do now. And most importantly, we can coordinate our efforts with lots of other people. That's just what we do. I mean, that if it weren't for those things, humanity really wouldn't be worth talking about. We'd be gibbons.
Yes. Yeah, for sure.
Well, hey, let me ask you about, if I look at your Twitter bio, it says you're interested in investments, Web3, macro, cloud, AI, semis. Is that trucks?
Semiconductors.
Oh, semiconductors. Okay. Okay. That makes more sense. Let's go back to the beginning of that list, Web3.
Yeah.
It is a you know, molten hot buzzword, but there's not a lot of agreement that I can find on what it actually means.
Yeah, I remember having this discussion with someone because I launched a crypto fund in November, and we were talking about Web3 and like, do you call it Web3? What is Web3? Is this a Web3 fund? Is it a crypto fund? Right. So I've gone through these iterations, and as far as I can tell, I remember the narrative. Maybe it's dropped now, but like, it seemed to me that they rebranded to Web3 because crypto was becoming sort of a tainted word. And so you could be like, well, I'm not a crypto investor, I'm a Web3 investor.
Gotcha.
Right. And to me, I think that's sort of where it is. Now, in the last like few weeks, all of a sudden I'm seeing people call Web5. I don't know if they're doing it like ironically, or they're just like, you know, accelerating the joke of like, we're just going to further iterations of web. I think a lot of the like A16Z and recent stuff on Web3 has, I don't know what to think there. I mean, they're the sort of the loudest, largest, you know, participant in the room, but it seems a little content light to me for whatever reason. You know, they talk about Web3 investing. To me, it seems like fairly obvious that like there's a lot more that needs to be done before we can even talk about what Web3 and ownership looks like. And if I had like the billions of dollars at Andreessen to allocate, I'd be prioritizing custody. Because we sort of have this problem. A friend of mine, Seth Priebitsch from Level Up, who's now in crypto, he said it well. He was like, the security issue with custody is almost like it's so hard that it either creates mistakes, it's easy to make mistakes, or it's like too complicated. And like, do you make it even more complicated or do you make it easier? And like, which direction do you go with custody? And I think that's like the number one problem. I don't think we're going to get any sort of Web3 or crypto additional adoption until we solve that. I think that's like I was convinced that's the next step that we have to address, because like, you can't have people clicking on links, getting phishing attacks, losing like their NFTs. Sure, they're NFTs now, but if they're real estate assets in the future, or IP assets, or something, you know, anything tied to any kind of asset value or income, like, it's so unacceptable. Chase works really well. So like, the Web3 argument is like horrible if you can get a phishing attack and lose your assets. Like, in that case, my bank works just fine.
For those who might not be up on this whole Web3 jargon, the idea is that the first web was basically read-only. Most of the people who were on it weren't really contributing any content to it. It was hard to build a website, you know, and there were no social media platforms. There were no places to just go and easily contribute to the global conversation. You went to the web to find stuff and consume it. Web 2 is basically everybody's participating now. It's the read-write web. It's the social media web. There's a lot more. Like, the original web was still sort of one to many in its distribution model, and Web 2 is really everybody's participating and contributing. And then Web 3, this is where things diverge, because I've heard some people say Web 3 is the executable web. It's basically, it is the web that is inhabited by and facilitated with like DAOs, you know, autonomous organizations where software is law, that, you know, mechanisms that used to require human governance are just executed in software now. So that's the executable web. But I've also heard it described as the semantic web, whereby, you know, there's AI with enough sophistication in terms of natural language processing basically the web just gets smart. It has a much better understanding of what it is you're actually interested in when you do a search, and what it provides you will be much more relevant. And those two things don't seem to be different descriptions of the same concept. Those seem to be different concepts entirely.
Yeah. Yeah. I've heard all the different, you know, narratives around what Web3 is as well, including like Web3 allows you to own things on the internet, right? Or store value on the internet, or transact and store value on the internet. And like, I'm not sure any of them are there yet. Like, I like looking at these base levels. Like, what do we actually have right now? And then Bitcoin, like, we definitely have. Like, we've had that for about a decade plus. So that exists. We have Ethereum, which is like the EVM. EVM stands for Ethereum Virtual Machine. And if you pay with Ethereum tokens, you can run calculations on the Ethereum Virtual Machine. And I think what's really cool about that, I don't know why this doesn't seem to get the coverage. What's cool about that is you don't need to ask anyone permission or create an account or get like approved to do that. So like when you're building a startup or you're doing this stuff, you need to go through unbelievable hoops to get approved to use, like, let's say Twilio. Like Twilio is a cloud computing platform that like allows you to send like text messages and do calls over the internet using like, you know, code, right? Programmatic methods. But like if you want to sign up for a Twilio account and just play around it, like you're going to have to get approval. They're going to have to make sure that they like you, that you're doing the right things. And like, that's, I think that's what's extremely attractive about the Ethereum Virtual Machine, because it doesn't care. As long as you pay it, you can use it for whatever you want. And I think that's what is so attractive to people about crypto, is that like, it is less bureaucracy. There is still a lot of bureaucracy in traditional technology, like that I've experienced personally, even just, and I'm not even like a programmer, right? It's just like, I don't do that much in cloud personally, and I still have these experiences. So you have crypto, you have blockchain, you have Bitcoin. Bitcoin's like number one. You have the Ethereum Virtual Machine, and then you have USDC, which is like the stablecoin one-to-one backed dollar. To me, that's like, those are the only three things that exist in crypto. Like the rest is a whole bunch of, I want to say, like, treat them as like seed stage startup investments. Like they promise that they could have some interesting, like forward-looking, you know, futuristic application. And like the next one on that list I would jump to is Helium. Helium is a decentralized, you know, crypto-driven wireless network. And it does get used. It's in LA, for example. LA has the most hotspots. So in theory, a Helium hotspot, like you buy them for like $500, you plug them into your wall, and you get paid in Helium token to provide internet connectivity. But the Lime scooter network, you know, it's electric scooters in LA, uses the Helium network there for its connectivity. So you're like, okay, that's real. Like you give out your internet to the network, to the local people, and you get paid in these tokens. And then a real company uses it. Like that's real. But I don't think there are very many like real things right now. And so like in order to actually call something Web3 or get to Web3, like we actually have to have these real things. And a lot of crypto is just this recursive trading, levering crypto against crypto with other native tokens. And that's what I was saying, like at the beginning, it's kind of like, that's not really real. That's cool proof of concept, but like, we don't have any real assets on there yet. So like what's neat, and I wrote about this today, because I publish an article every Thursday talking about Swift.
Where do you publish?
On osbondcapital.com.
Okay.
That's the article. But talking about Swift, and like right now,
so Swift is a way to clear money transfers internationally, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Anyone in the world right now, anyone, like someone in Philippines, anywhere, literally any in the world, can create an Ethereum wallet really quickly, no permission, and I can send them USDC, no permission, no requests, no blocks. Like it is the most seamless technical experience you could possibly have. Now, like, yeah, it requires a little bit of understanding about like what a wallet is and how to get the USDC, but at no point do you need a human to approve you to use that system. And it's super cheap. I mean, a transaction is cheap. Like sending money is cheap. The gas fees are not cheap, but that's another component. We all know about that. But like the ability to just like get that USDC and send a dollar to someone anywhere in the world, like that's a real dollar. Like it's not, it is backed. It's not some kind of, you know, fake internet money. Like that exists. So like, that's really cool. I mean, that is a real Web3 thing. And it's sort of like, I know everyone's saying like, right now I asked that question is like, everyone's so down on it, but like, I don't know, that's real.
You know, I laughed when you said fake internet money, because that that phrase, I've read it a lot, and it's sort of an argument unto itself that doesn't need to be made. It's just question begging. It's just asserting, you know, crypto doesn't matter what you do with it or who's willing to trade what for it. It's not money. It's not real money. You know, it's just an assertion, but it's a very powerful string of syllables. Fake internet money.
Yeah. It's great. It's a great, it's got great meme quality, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
So we've been recording for over an hour now. I won't keep you much longer, but I do have one more question. One of the fundamental themes of this podcast is the notion of decentralization. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm a decades long, cantankerous, you know, libertarian, malcontent. But at the same time, and, you know, as such, I should be really gung-ho for decentralization. But at the same time, I think sometimes decentralization can be a gloss over what is really just fragmentation. Mm. That, you know, devolving power, if you don't do it in such a way that it maintains our ability to coordinate our actions, then it's not a good thing. So a system that is fragmented and where the parts don't work with one another, it may be decentralized, but it's not decentralized in any sort of way that is desirable or, you know, useful. I wonder if you have any sort of 30,000 foot observations about just the notion of decentralization.
I think that's a really good question. I mean, at the Crypto Bahamas, you know, we had the founders of these alternative layer ones and a lot of the high people who are high up in crypto, and they did point out multiple times that there is no real mathematical way to define decentralization. Like, we haven't created a formula around it. We sort of have a notion of decentralization as like a certain number of nodes, like a certain level of distribution of like the wealth, you know, across the different operators, so that like not any single person or, you know, and there are all these amazing like little, you know, kind of game theory experiments, right, where you talk about different attacks. I don't remember the names of them, but like, but yeah, I think you're touching on a really hard question. I think that is actually like, that's somewhat existential to this entire thing, right? So it's probably the hardest question of this, because that is like, that's what people say Bitcoin solved, right? You have a decentralized network. And what was amazing about the Bitcoin kind of paper system is that it's so expensive to destroy the network that it deters people from trying to destroy the network, right? To get the 51% attack or whatever, it would be too expensive. You'd just be wiping out more value than you would be creating. So I guess that's decentralization, right? Like, it's sort of like it's stable. It's like the table that's made out of the chains that like one chain in the middle is holding, and it's tension that's holding the whole system together. Maybe decentralization is just tension that's holding the whole system together. It's like you've successfully pitted all the actors against each other. They're all hostile and they're all angry, but there's nothing they can do about it. And maybe that's where we end up, right? Which is like, despite everyone's like desire to take over a system, the incentives will be too negative to allow them to do that.
I'm reminded of a quote from Batman's butler, Alfred, as played by Michael Caine in the Christopher Nolan films, talking about the Joker, saying,
"Some men aren't looking for anything logical, like money. They can't be bought, bullied, reasoned, or negotiated with. Some men just want to watch the world burn."
Yeah.
You know, so that's the 51% attack. I mean, in that movie, Joker steals a whole bunch of money from the mob. He piles it up in a warehouse in cash, douses it with gasoline, and throws a match on it.
Yeah. Nice.
And, you know, our world is, I won't say full of people like that, but there's enough people like that in the world willing to just see the whole thing destroyed,
yeah,
because it validates their point of view, that's a danger we cannot ignore.
Yeah. Well, it reminds me a little bit of like where globalization is good for stopping wars, right? So you have economic intertwinement. And so like the money is like kind of the more important thing than the war. And so like, if you are reliant on each other and you have so much intertwined economic activity, that should theoretically prevent people or make the incentives, you know, align enough where there is less conflict. Yeah.
Let's hope. All right. Well, Max Osborne, I've enjoyed our conversation very much. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, KMO.
Take care.
That was Max Osborne of Osborne Capital Management.
And having just re-listened to that conversation, I noticed that Max wanted to change the topic to climate change. And in the process, I kind of went on a bit of a ramble and talked a lot about doomerism, which is this fixation on the notion that we are doomed. There is nothing that can be done to save industrial civilization. And I don't really think we got around to Max's point on climate change. The main point on that topic from him that I got out of this conversation is that some measure of adaptation will be required. That at this point, there's probably no avoiding the consequences of anthropogenic climate change. And you know what? I'm agnostic on that topic. I am not pushing that topic at you. Make of it what you will. But I do agree that some adaptation to changing conditions will be required. But as I stressed in the conversation you just heard, as human beings, that's kind of our thing. That's what we do. That's our evolutionary strategy, is adaptability and teamwork. That's what our intelligence is good for. All right, well, I hope you enjoyed what you heard in this episode. We have several more episodes already recorded, ready to throw onto the RSS feed and deliver right to your ears. So if you're not already subscribed, I would highly encourage you to subscribe to this podcast so you never miss an episode. And before I go, I'd like to thank the PadVerb team. That's executive producer Anna Haskell, producers Slava Borisov and Alina Voigt, with music by Slava Borisov. If you have a comment, you can send me email. My email address is kmo@padverb.com. But now there's also a PadVerb podcast Telegram channel. And I think you can find links to it on padverb.com in the description for this episode. If you look around for it and you don't find it, feel free to send me an email. Again, it's kmo@padverb.com. All right, that is all. But I will be back with another conversation 1 week from today. Talk to you then.